A podcast of the cinema.
Starring that homosexual celebrity of Turner Classic Movies named Alonzo Duralde. Now, I know that you were on with a different homosexual.
Named Dave.
Named, different, not me, but Dave Karger.
Yes.
And he's fine.
Sure.
But you're the new president of Turner Classic Movies.
No, that
because
was
you were on actual television Friday night.
Yes,
on Turner Classic Movies.
I made a cameo
hosting three, not one, not two, but three films in a row on Turner Classic Movies.
I made a cameo, not to be confused with the cameo where you're supposed to pay $15,000 to talk to Jeremy's Piven via Zoom for 10 minutes.
Right. Sorry. Get the name right.
Yes, for $15,000, you better.
When did you... Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, wait. Let's... What? When did you hear about the Jeremy Piven?
Somebody tweeted it with a shot of the thing on Cameo that says...
Has he had one
a taker? I don't know.
Customer yet?
I don't know.
Furthermore, does he guarantee 10 minutes of Ellen gossip?
Because that might be.
Because then I'd start a GoFundMe.
You,
for that.
You, by the way, are Dave White.
Sure.
You are my co-host. You are my husband.
Yeah. But I was not.
No.
On Turner Classic Movies
but
on Friday night.
You,
and therefore, I don't matter.
Oh, shush. You fixed my beard. You fixed the background up all
yes,
nice.
I did. I dusted the bookshelves. I made them nice and neat. I took out titles on spines that had the F word in them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had three of those. And I took out...
I have not been watching a lot of these segments from other folks at home, but somebody I know who is a devoted TCM watcher was like, well, you wouldn't believe what some people have behind them during their Zooms.
I'm sorry, what now?
Somebody who watches TCM who is complimenting our bookshelf
the
game.
The neatness and cleanliness.
Yes, was saying you wouldn't believe what some of these folks have behind them.
Oh, I've seen some things.
So, you know.
I've seen some things on
other
Zooms.
Networks for sure, yes.
So we took that off the shelf. I took off a book, a critical essay length, a book length critical essay called "Is the Rectum a Grave?"
Well, as it turns out,
listen,
with my cruddy,
I enjoy a little academic writing from time to time.
With my cruddy laptop camera, you couldn't really clearly make out anything. Like, there was a copy of Joan Crawford's My Way of Life right behind my head the whole time, and I don't know if anybody could really tell.
Well, I saw the Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was scanning the screen to see if titles were popping out, and none of them really were.
Yeah.
The Charles Schultz
biography
with the Charlie Brown zigzag on the spine, that was a little recognizable.
Gotcha.
But then you wouldn't, unless you knew what it was, you'd just be like, what's that zigzag?
I don't have one of those Ify Wadaway crispy 4K cameras getting like every...
No, you had soft, flattering focus.
This is true.
You had that. You have that.
That honey glow.
That hazy. That hazy. You know, Mae West in
Myra Breckinridge.
In Myra Breckinridge.
Anyway, if this is your first time listening and you found us via TCM, welcome.
Yes.
We're thrilled you're here.
You might like this show.
Yes.
You also might hate it.
Also a possibility.
If you hate it, well, we hate you too.
No. No. No hard feelings. Just move on.
Oh, there will be hard feelings.
Just don't leave us like a really mean iTunes review. Just move on. It's not for you. Fine. Fine.
Have we ever had a
we've had like there's like one star review, I think.
Really?
I think
this is like back in the day.
I forget.
Or was it recently?
I don't
remember. Were you just keeping it for me this whole time?
We've talked about it before.
Was it the lady that hated my voice?
I don't remember.
I remember the lady who hated my voice.
For the most part, people have been very good about following your explicit instructions to leave a 5-star review.
If you're going
to
leave a review, it better be 5 stars.
So, and we appreciate everyone that we get.
I've got time.
There's algorithms that this
I got has, time for any 4-star nonsense.
To do with, so we always love getting them, so thank you for that. And if this isn't your first time, welcome back.
Yes, welcome back to all the friends who are, you know,
here
every week.
Yes.
For nearly 10 years.
That's getting there.
Yeah, it is.
It is quite likely we will spend both of these anniversaries trapped in this apartment, but we are coming up on 10 years of the show.
Yeah.
And
our 25th
anniversary.
Our 25th anniversary of love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
We're real old.
We're so old.
I have more questions about your star-making performance on Turner Classic Movies.
I will do my best to answer them.
What did they edit out that you thought was real smart, and you thought, "Oh, this is a mwah," and they're gonna keep it, and they're gonna love me, and then they chopped it. What did they cut out?
I can't think of anything because the thing is, like, none of this was scripted. This was me and Dave having a chat.
Can I interrupt? Like, I'm asking permission to interrupt.
You will anyway.
Well, I will anyway. But, like, as I said to you Friday night, as we sat on the couch and watched all three host intros, I had already seen all three of these films.
Yes.
And after the introduction to the documentary Word Is Out, which started at 8:45.
Yes. That was bedtime for you.
That was bedtime for me. I was asleep. It was time for me to go to bed. I forgot what I was going to say.
Dave and I were having a conversation that was unscripted. And as you said on Friday.
As I said to you on Friday, I'm so always so proud of you and impressed by your ability to speak off the cuff. Just extemporaneously. No trouble at all. I am the biggest hammer and whore and lose my train of thoughter in the world.
Well,
the only reason it's not worse on this show than you already know it to be is because we cut and pick it up again while I gather my brains up.
Look, doing this show, going on the radio every so often, doing film festival Q&As. It's just a skill I've picked up.
Even when we go on KCRW once a month,
mm-hmm.
local NPR station, I have to have my notes. I write down, if we are going into the studio before the virus, when we would go into the studio, mm-hmm. I would have my little note cards with me every single time, where I would write down all the things I felt like I really needed to make sure that I got, out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I can write up basically a whole little script for myself and just read.
Look, every so often, I will look at a turn of phrase or I'll make an actual mistake,
right.
certainly, which has happened on the podcast numerous times, and I'll be like, and I'll kind of cringe over it. But I don't know, for the most part, I feel like if I write it down, the challenge then is for me to make it not sound that way. Like when I did the Filmstruck stuff,
yeah.
those were all written.
Yes.
And
then I helped you.
And you helped me, and I had to, like, really work on...
Helped you make it sound like a conversation.
Exactly. Being on camera, making it sound like it was off the cuff when it was very much wasn't. What was the... Oh, I had to learn to stop using the word particularly.
Particularly.
Because that's a mouthful.
so many things that one can write that one cannot say.
Exactly. So I don't remember anything that I thought was like, ooh, good, I got a good one in there.
Right.
I was kind of amazed they left in my really stupid joke about
my
linoleum
floor, my floor renovation days, or my kitchen renovation days are behind me.
Yeah, like that was just, that was just nervous because I realized in the moment that they asked me, where can they find you? Like, we let linoleum-knife.com die.
Yeah.
We haven't built linoleumknife.com yet, which we do finally have the URL for.
We own linoleumknife.com. We haven't done anything with it yet. Yeah.
So, and I just...
This just happened.
Yeah, so I didn't know where to send people. So I was just like, Google my name and linoleum knife. Like, which is, you know... Look, really Google my name. I'm the only Alonzo Duralde.
You're the only Alonzo Duralde on the planet. The, No, but yeah, like, you're always so... You're like, you're a smooth operator when you're on... When you're on TV or on a Q&A stage. And I... The minute I get out of... The minute I get up from this dining room table...
Mm-hmm.
Where I have recorded this show with you for going on 10. If I have to talk to anybody else and keep talking, the heat is on and I'm dead. So I got to take my notes to KCRW. When I had to do the KCRW, when I had to do the live show
Unfictional
3 days before, my producer was like, oh, yeah, this is, we're just going to, you just get up there and talk. And I'm like, that's not, I don't do that. I don't do that. I wrote a story. I will read that story. Meanwhile, everybody else is coming out on stage like, blah, blah, blah. I'm just bringing this off the top of my head.
Okay.
Dude from the Moth.
I was going to say.
Susan Orlean, Tig Notaro.
Yeah,
they're all just like, yeah, I can just talk and talk and talk.
These are people that do that stuff for a living.
Right.
So you did great.
I'm not, no, well, because I was reading. Yes. Yeah, I was great. I love reading things in front of people. But when I'm not here with you. Like, I'm talking into a microphone right now, but I don't think about it being listened to by a million other people.
Sure.
I wish a million other people.
Dozens and dozens of other people.
Oh, let's say hundreds. It's been nearly 10 years.
Sure.
Hundreds of people.
We've earned that.
Yeah. And, but, yo, I can't. Oh, no. I can't. Because I go blank. I freeze. I go blank. And I'm not nervous about people. I'm nervous about... making sure that I remember everything in the order that I want to say it.
Sure. Well, it's the ham in me. I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's the being a youngest child with a wide gap and just getting very used to, like, butting my way into the conversation. I don't know. But thank you. I'm glad that I'm glad it worked. I have to say, I watched it all and almost never felt like, oh, why did I say that? Or, oh, where am I looking?
No, you know, you were...
Like, it felt very cash. And Dave Carger
yeah.
is a super pro at this. And so
he really
made it very comfortable for me. And, you know, it's the having had several months to get used to Zoom at this point.
Right.
You know, that I was able to kind of like have this chat with him on our computers and it was fine. You know?
I want to ask him about that big light up star in his living room. I have to know. I have to know about what that is.
It was on his dressing room door.
I assume that was his living room.
I'm guessing.
I assume he was home. I mean, everyone does it from home now.
Yeah.
Unless, is there a studio now? Does Ben go into a studio?
No, Ben does it from home.
Ben also does it from home. Okay. Yeah. I thought maybe that he. I know there's a studio here in Los Angeles.
But no
one's going to it. Okay.
So they're all doing their own makeup too, which is impressive. I opted to just wing it without.
But you just like, had a. You, they sent you that ring light, and everything was nice, and you didn't need makeup. And,
yeah. Again, thanks to my blurry laptop camera, I was younger than springtime and twice as exciting.
Yes, I. You know. You can buy all the makeup that Mac can make. I've done that joke before. I won't continue.
Have.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of Valley of the Dolls, which I just referenced, we are still talking to Stephen Ribello about his amazing, fun, essential new book, Dolls, Dolls, Dolls.
I started reading it the other day.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I'm rereading it now. It's such fun. There was some issue that we weren't able to make the original interview happen, but it's going to happen this week. We're going to release that as its own fun little separate episode, and he is. One of my mentors as a writer, it's always just been incredibly supportive, and I'm so excited for him about this book because it is. I feel like it's a book that I could have dreamed into happening. I'm so happy it exists, and I'm doubly happy that he's the one who wrote it because it's exactly his wheelhouse. You know, he's the guy who wrote Hitchcock and the Making of Hit and Psycho, co-wrote Bad Movies We Love. You know, a great, great writer, really loves the subject and just like gives you just every page just like morsels of delicious dish.
That's what, that is the experience of having dinner with him. I know that.
Yes, so. Exactly. So we'll be talking about that this week, and I can't wait.
What movies are we going to talk about so that we can get, oh man, it's 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Already. All right. I got to tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get all this done by 6.
Okay.
Yeah. We have to crank it out.
Okay.
No more fiddle faddle.
Okay.
No more chit chat. No more
screaming yellow zonkers.
None of that. We got to get to the movies at hand.
Yes. The movies at hand are The King of Staten Island.
Let's go.
Okay.
Starring Pete Davidson.
Yes.
By Judd Apatow.
As Pete
Co-starring.
Davidson. Bell Powley.
Wait. By Judd Apatow, Pete Davidson, starring as Pete Davidson.
Basically.
And all of his many tattoos.
Yes.
Because he's almost always shirtless. Like, why is he shirtless so much in this movie?
Well, if you had that many tattoos, it sort of it feels like you're never naked. You
check
know?
It out. Well, no, I mean, okay, sure.
I don't know.
I mean, it takes a long time to grow the tattoos. So when you're done, I guess you're proud.
We were talking about this. Like, yeah. It used to be that people who were covered in tattoos, there was a guiding aesthetic in a way. Like, when people talked about, like, my sleeve, there was...
Oh, are you going to get on this again?
Well,
all right,
no,
do it.
You and I talked about it. We haven't talked
You're
about it.
You're wrong, but do it. Keep going.
Anyway, I think Pete Davidson represents a new or newish aesthetic of the tattoo, which...
In the past decade, this has been the emerging paradigm... for how young people generally, although we have some friends who are slightly older, who are doing the same thing.
Yes. I call it the doodle pad. You know, the pad you keep by the phone, and then, like, while you're on hold, you'll, like, draw an elephant, or you'll draw a car on fire, or you'll draw a building, or an airplane, or a blimp, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and so rather than sort of have, like, this entire, my left arm is an Aztec rose garden, while my right arm is a whatever.
Right.
Like, it's just like, here's a little thing, and then next is another little thing, and then another little thing, and then just like, it's a doodle pad. And so that's sort of what the finished product. And I only mention it because you see so much of Pete Davidson's torso in this movie.
Yeah.
And he plays somebody who is an aspiring tattoo artist.
So what you're saying is you hate people who have these kinds of tattoos. Isn't that really what you're saying?
I don't understand any tattoos at all because I'm so freaked out about needles and also just the idea of, like, permanence.
Right.
So the whole tattoo thing is... eluded me until now, or continues to, rather. So I don't differentiate which style you have embraced. Either way, I'm like, good on you for you. No thank you.
What you're really saying is that you should be able to dictate what people do with their own bodies.
Well, sure. No. Not my... No.
That time I... almost got a tattoo, and you said, I'll kick you to the curb. And I said, oh, no, don't do that to me, please. Please don't leave me. So then I didn't get the tattoo.
Beginning with the idea of you almost getting a tattoo is where this story goes completely off the rails, much less the rest of it.
My beautiful fat body is free of tattoos.
Yes.
And you know what? I never had the... the interest.
They would clash with my moles and skin tags.
Okay. So anyway.
Pete Davidson plays a fairly autobiographical character. He is a young man in his early 20s. His father died when he was a young man as a firefighter. In real life, Pete Davidson's dad died of 9/11. In this movie, he died in a hotel fire.
Yeah.
He is still living at home with his widowed mother, played by Marissa Tomei. His younger sister, played by Maude Apatow, has just graduated high school and is off to college. And her getting on with her life sort of calls into relief how much he isn't. And so Belle Powley plays an old friend of his. They sleep together and she's into him, but he has so little self-esteem that he doesn't see the point in beginning a relationship, so he keeps her at arm's length. Marissa Tomei starts dating another fireman played by comedian Bill Burr.
Yeah.
And eventually the two of them sort of conspire to get Pete Davidson's character to move out. Ultimately he winds up kind of crashing at the firehouse where Bill Burr works and comes to make some decisions about where his life is going to go. That's the movie in a nutshell. And it's Judd Apatow. So it's more than 2 hours long.
Oh, it's nearly 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And I know everyone likes to dump on him for these super long ass movies, but I kind of like him.
I used to.
And I've always kind of liked him. And the reason is that his characters, for me, are people that I enjoy listening to.
Sure.
I enjoy listening to them talk. They say funny stuff. They are not always getting to the point. Perhaps that's one thing I enjoy about them.
Could be.
You and I tend to digress a lot when we speak, particularly on this podcast.
Sure.
And to me, that sounds like real life. And so I don't mind the length of these films. I just assume, because it's a Judd Apatow movie, that it's going to be super long. The one that I did not enjoy was This Is 40.
That's the thing. I used to be very forgiving about the length when the movies were better, but This Is 40 and this one are both like, oh, I see where that.
Oh, I would not compare this to This Is 40 at all.
It's better than This Is 40, but
I think the problem for me with This Is 40 is that when you are 40 and you are behaving like you're 22 and, you know, whining about how you don't know what you want to do with your life, but already you are 40 and rich.
Yeah.
Which is what those characters were.
Mm-hmm.
I think to myself, get the fuck out of here.
You and your house can shut up.
Yeah, exactly. So, but this one returns, you know, to the conflicted young man territory that Judd Apatow does.
Sure.
His best work with. And I thought...
Would you call this his best work? Among his best work?
No. The earlier films were lighter and more about, you know, goofy situations.
Mm.
And sometimes something meaningful would happen. But lately he's decided he wants to be meaningful. And so and I'm fine with that too. I find it unusual that cinematographer Robert Elswit, who, you know, did Inherent Vice and
There Will Be Blood
and
Nightcrawler.
Yeah. I mean, he also did Gigli, but like I didn't feel like there was a lot of visual language happening.
Well, it's like when who shot Kevin Smith's Jersey Girl? It was somebody like,
I don't remember.
It was one of those sort of like great Italian cinematographers. Like,
yeah,
okay.
So that was a little confusing to me. I mean, this film looks fine.
Oh, yeah.
But it's, you know, it's people standing around talking.
It's no every frame a picture.
Yeah. Or what, every frame a
portrait.
A portrait, every frame a portrait. Anyway, so, which brings us down really to the writing and the acting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind the looseness of the writing. I don't mind that he meanders and takes his time. I don't mind that he wants to tell too many stories with too many characters, which is what he's doing here. None of that bothers me. I thought Pete Davidson, Pete Davidson's performance was lovely as a person who's very much like himself. Someone who suffers from anxiety and depression and who is still carrying the burden of growing up without a father. Who finds someone in his mother's, you know, boyfriend who could be that kind of guy for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's never too late. But actively pushes him away and pushes him away from her as well.
Yeah.
And so that is, you know, that's an interesting story to me. You know, what are young men supposed to be now? And that is one of the stories being told here. I think that often, you know, lately, because we want to see stories about someone other than a young straight white dude, that movies about young straight white dudes are just getting worse and worse. Like, more and more meaningless.
Mm.
And if we're going to have a movie about a young straight white dude, why not make it be about something? And that's what this is. So, you know, I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater is what I'm saying.
Sure, no.
You know, if one comes along and it's pretty decent, here's one that's pretty decent.
My kind of about this movie has nothing to do with the white straight guy-ness of it. It just sort of felt, I mean, it I don't know. It does meander. Boy, does it meander. I don't know. I don't know if it's I'm getting tired of the Judd Apatow formula at this point.
Well, he does have a...
I mean, he hasn't made a movie in 5 years, but like, you know.
Judd Apatow does have a way about him.
And I love...
And you know what that way is and you know where it's going.
Yeah, but I love the early films, you know, and even, you know, like I like 5 Year Engagement a lot, which he didn't direct, but he produced and feels very much of his oeuvre, you know. But yeah, there was this one I was just kind of like, don't care that much. Mm. Like, you know, and Pete Davidson is fine. We talked about this on Breakfast All Day this week. I'll be curious to see if he wants to be an actor and if he wants to do so playing roles that aren't like himself, just because in this year already we've had Time Adolescence where
is not great.
Not as good as this is, but he's also playing a very Pete Davidson-ish character.
Yes, he is.
But, you know, I think this does play on a lot of Apatow's strengths. Great ensemble cast. You know, I would have loved to see...
Marissa Tomei.
I would have loved more for Marissa Tomei to do, but she definitely has some moments that are great.
She makes use of every moment she's in the film.
Yeah, but like, you know, Pamela Adlon has some really funny moments. Bill Burr is quite good. Steve Buscemi. And really, for me, Belle Powley.
Belle Powley.
I thought, because this is such a... That's a role that so easily could have just been like the understanding girl, and she imbues it with this real sense of she's somebody who's got ambitions. She's somebody who knows this guy better than he knows himself and sees what's there when he can't see it yet, and captures that in a really interesting way that just doesn't just feel like she's waiting for him to like become good enough for her. You know?
No, yeah, exactly. Like she, even up until the very moment that it ends, she's like, what are you doing? why are you bothering me?
Exactly.
I
mean, so I there are things about it I like, but I'm not enthusiastic about
this. If you know you don't care, then don't bother, but I, you know, I liked it.
It's worth seeing for the things that work. I just wish there were more of those things.
Like, you kind of have to have a welcoming attitude about the concept of Pete Davidson.
I'm not against him.
And well, I know a lot of people are not for him at all.
No, for sure. Yeah.
So,
They're not going to be won over by this.
No, they're not, because that's him. It's him being
him. Since we are trying to make best use of our time.
That's right.
Let's be very brief.
No wasted space.
Let's be very brief about Artemis Fowl.
I've got chili cheese dogs I got to make when this is over. It's very important, and it has to be done by 6:30.
I've been looking forward to it all week. I was not, however, looking forward to Artemis. Well, no, I take it back. I had high hopes for Artemis Fowl.
When?
And
when did you tell me this?
Because before the early reviews started coming out, it was a thing where I thought, okay, the premise of this sounds like it could be kind of fun, like kid super spy, criminal, whatever.
Okay.
I did not know about the fairies and sprites and, you know, trolls part of it. I just thought it was kid with tech stuff. And it was Kenneth Branagh directing. And I thought, okay, well, people love these books. Some people love these books. Like, maybe this will be something. A thing I have learned the hard way in this job, seeing movies that I would not have normally just paid a ticket for, but had to see them for work,
mm-hmm.
is that when you get a movie that has been knocking around for a while,
almost 20 years.
Yeah, well, but even just this, as a finish, that he's been knocking around for a couple. Yeah. Been knocking around for a while is supposed to be the launch pad for a franchise.
Yeah.
And it comes in right at around the 90-minute mark or shorter. You
what
know,
can that mean?
You know you are in big trouble.
Yeah.
Because that means that, like, the too many cooks are now in the process of taking things away. Like, when they've decided there's nothing we can add to make this work, so
what
all we can
we
do
chop?
We all we can yeah. do is shave it down to the essentials and hope that people just that it goes through people like, you know, pate through a goose.
This film's journey from book to film is so convoluted and tortured.
Yeah.
Like, nearly 20 years
yeah.
of various directors and scripts getting passed around, going in and out of development. And I'll be real. I did all my homework on this, like, the day before we watched it. Because I thought, did J.K. Rowling write this? Like, this is how little I know about Artemis Fowl.
Right.
Not a damn thing. But so finally, Kenneth Branagh comes along. He sticks as the director. This is based on Ewan Colfer's series of YA fantasy novels.
Apparently they crammed the first two books into this movie, from what I hear.
Sorry for those books. It's all in the wake of Harry Potter. You know, it took so long to get this done that, as I said the other day on the radio, all the Harry Potter movies came and gone. All the Harry Potter books come and gone. The YA movie trend come and gone. Some of them started off as big full speed ahead franchises and wound up streaming on by the time they got to the last movie because no one gave a damn about seeing them in the theater
Did
anymore.
Did they even make the last Allegiant movie?
I don't know.
Like it was for a while. It was like okay,
it was Divergent.
Well, yeah, it started as Divergent. They were gonna like it was gonna be a franchise in theaters, and then they were gonna release the last one like direct to TV or something. And I don't think they even made it,
really.
And no one cared, no one clamored for it. I need resolution to Divergent.
So there's a hidden world of magical creatures. You got your trolls, your goblins, your elves, your fairies, your monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Artemis Fowl, he's a super genius. He's a criminal mastermind.
12 years old.
And played by a kid named Ferdius Shaw. I guess, I don't know, I've never seen
He's
him before.
He's Robert Shaw's grandson.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Fascinating. Well, how did he ever break into the business?
You know, the hard way.
So his grandfather is Quint from Jaws.
Yes.
Wow. Now that's news to me right
yeah.
now. Yeah. Anyway, he announces himself as this criminal mastermind, but he just kind of comes off as like a semi-rebellious kid with a somewhat occasionally cocky attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he likes to surf, and that's the only personality trait that we really know about.
Yeah,
because
he's surfing in Ireland.
They show him surfing. His dad is Colin Farrell.
Yes.
His dad goes missing. Artemis Fowl, the first senior. And so Artemis Fowl then has to join forces with all the magical creatures to find his dad and then get
the doohickey.
The thingy. The glowy, shiny, the
powerful
Rubik's cubey, powery egg, whatever it
Acorn.
Is.
Acorn. Christy Lemire had a...
She called it a butt plug.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, sure.
She's not wrong.
But that's just the story. The movie is an unmitigated disaster. It is such
so much yelling,
chaotic mess. When we were on the radio Friday talking about it, they pulled a clip that had people speaking actual sentences.
Mm-hmm. Cobbled together from various scenes.
I was like, where'd they get that? I don't remember three sentences being spoken coherently in this
whole
movie.
All I remember is,
yeah, it's people going, crash. Whee!
And Josh Gad farting dirt.
Josh Gad farts dirt like a cannon.
Yes.
At the enemies.
Because he's a troll. He burrows with his mouth and then expels.
Eats the dirt and then poops it out as a weapon.
Yeah.
He's a weaponized farts.
And Josh Gad, by the way, you would think at some point in this production process, somebody would have looked and said, you look exactly like Hagrid. Let's maybe go back to the drawing board on this character. Like, nope, we're just going to leave him looking exactly like Hagrid.
Everything feels like received information, like borrowed ideas. And I don't know what these books are like at all.
Me neither.
And I will never read them. but the production design, the digital effects, it's just this big swirly whoosh of pixels and crashing noises, and the sound design is, I'm sorry, crashing noises is the sound design.
Yes.
The sound design is the crashing noises and the screaming and whispering and grunting and growling.
And Judi Dench is an elf cop or fairy cop or something.
She was my favorite thing. Because she sounds like, and this is going to be a reference that is lost on all but five of you, maybe, and I'm not trying to be elitist here with this. It's just that I have a particular taste in music.
Oh.
And that taste in music is outsider black metal, which is different from regular black metal.
You know.
And I just, there's this band that does no longer exist called Necrofrost. And their guy, their vocalist sounds like a grandma being sort of strangled by devils. And so that's what Judi Dench's voice sounds like in this movie. And
she sounds like Popeye, period.
Eh. Okay, sure. Call it a
like,
Popeye voice.
Like the old Popeye who's constantly muttering him to himself. I can't believe this. That's what she's doing. It's insane.
She says she is a fairy who sounds like a goblin. Let's just be, I don't know what she was thinking.
A goblin who needs a lozenge.
Costume is great, though. Just electric green everything.
Pointy
including,
ears.
Yeah, pointy ears. Including an electric green, like, official commander sort of hat that has
drop down cataract shades.
Green, like, shades. She looks cool. She looks as cool in this movie as she looked in her cat's costume. And she looked real cool in her cat's costume.
She looked way cooler as old
well,
Jute.
You, listen. Judi and I were tight.
Uh-huh.
And I...
You haven't even watched the tree show yet.
I haven't yet, but I'm going to.
You need to watch that.
I'm so excited to watch the Judi Dench
Talks About Trees
show. And anyway, like... So she's... getting paid.
Yes, she is.
And I hope she got paid quite a bit. And I want Maggie Smith and Eileen Atkins and Joan Plowright to all summon her to Joan Plowright's home.
Mm-hmm. Tea with the Dames 2.
And just grill her for 90 minutes about cats and this movie.
Yeah.
Like a judge. Oh, judge. Let's judge Judi.
There That's you what go.
Tea with the Dames 2.
Colon.
Judging Judi.
Judging Judi. And if she has any tulip fever stories she wants to share,
she can talk about
we
tulip
accept
fever
that as well.
As well, a film I saw in a theater alone.
So did I. I went to the one press screening at the very last minute.
So anyway, the script, who knows what it was like in its initial stages and if it told a coherent story. But the way we've got it all chopped to pieces now, I spent most of the film looking at you saying, what's happening? I don't understand what's happening. At one point, a character actually screams, what is happening?
Yes. I was like, I feel you.
And I was like, I don't know. What is happening?
You tell me.
There are so many useless pop culture references in the script. A joke about goblins and gluten that somebody decided they were going to fight for. They were going to fight for that in the final cut, and it stayed. Never meant to get out of the rough draft phase. I despise this film, except for Judi Dench.
It sucked the life out of me.
Worse, I was bored by it. I was fighting, falling asleep.
So boring. I mean, we're about to talk about Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, which is like 2 hours and 40-ish minutes.
235.
235. Yeah. That zips by in a way that the 90-ish minutes of Artemis Fowl feel like they're still happening.
This is a shredded attempt to build a franchise world, but all they managed to do is compress two books into a film that's not even 90 minutes. And if you're a fan of these books, that should tell you something with a big loud shout.
Yeah.
That whatever you loved about these books
did not carry
is over. Now a truncated, hurried, swirling mess of nothing.
R.L. Stein, the creator of the Goosebumps series.
Yeah.
And former writer for Dynamite Magazine,
yeah.
Did some tweet about, like, ignore the critics. Artemis Fowl is a delight or something. And everybody was like, and how much did Disney pay you to tweet this?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. One thing I did say on KCRW that I think got chopped was that it's depressing to look at the closing credits. Because you see the hundreds and hundreds of people who worked all these long, hard hours.
Yes, diligently.
On that. Something that has turned into just a hollow shell.
Yeah.
It makes me feel bad when I see all those names. I'm like, oh, you,
like,
you know.
Like Judi Dench, they were getting paid. Not nearly as much
probably
as Judi
Dench.
Probably
not nearly enough either.
But something.
All those post-production houses.
Oh, yeah.
People don't get paid enough.
Oh, they get screwed, I know. Yeah. Anyway.
The Five Bloods.
On to happier topics. The Five Bloods.
Please talk about the plot.
So this is Spike Lee's latest. Yes. He is so prolific.
Yeah, he makes like two movies a year.
Cranks those babies out.
He's always making something.
So this is a film about four best friends who are four friends, Vietnam War buddies, who reunite in Vietnam, ostensibly to collect the remains of their fifth, you know, tight friend who died in action. But they're really there because when they were, the five of them buried a cache of gold bricks from a CIA plane, and they want to go back and recoup it. And so not only do you get sort of their relationships to each other, we also get their flashbacks. The current day guys are played by Isaiah Whitlock Jr. and Clark Peters, and what is the stage guy's name? Norm Lewis, who, you know, is a
Les Mis.
Played Javert in the West End.
Yeah.
And especially Delroy Lindo, who is extraordinary in this, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And then in the flashbacks, we meet their fifth comrade, who's played by Chadwick Boseman. Jonathan Majors from Last Black Man in San Francisco pops up as Delroy Lindo's son, and he joins them on this mission. And so it is part kind of a movie about, part just straight up genre heist movie with very explicit shout outs to the treasures of the Sierra Madre.
And Apocalypse Now.
It's also a commentary about Hollywood movies about Vietnam, including Apocalypse Now and like the 80s oeuvre of Sylvester Stallone and Chuck Norris.
Right.
But it's also an examination of the politics behind black soldiers in Vietnam and other wars.
Right.
Fighting on behalf of the United States when the United States was and is treating them like second-class citizens. You know, and Spike Lee, of course, just swirls all of these ideas and themes and tones together, and it comes out brilliantly. I think this is one of his best movies.
He throws so much at you.
In the first 5 minutes, you get vintage footage of Muhammad Ali talking about how the Vietnamese never called him the N-word. You get Stokely Carmichael. You get Angela Davis. You get Bobby Seale.
A character mentions Aretha Franklin at one point in just casual conversation, and the movie stops and throws you a still photograph of Aretha Franklin, just because who doesn't want to look at a cool old picture of Aretha Franklin? Spike Lee does, and therefore, so do you.
Delroy Lindo's character is a conservative, and somebody makes a joke about him being the guy who sat behind Trump at that speech, and then we get a clip of that Trump speech with the guy behind him.
Kind of blurred out.
Yeah, but with an arrow pointing to him. Spike Lee, when I say bag of tricks, I don't mean it as a dismissive way or anything, but I mean, like, he has a facility and a delight in cinema language.
Yeah.
And he is just bringing it all into this.
He references early cinema. He argues with earlier cinema. And like you were saying, he's the opposite of a minimalist. As much as you can possibly be.
Like, he's a maximalist.
He keeps his visual field alive and moving, spinning around. This is a film about so many things. I said on Friday, it's about war. It's about memory. It's about history. It's a heist movie. It's a friendship drama. It's about blackness. It's about reparations. It's about poverty and capitalism and what that makes people do, whether they want to or not. It's about colonialism, the legacy of that. It's about, you know, the fact that black Americans are about 12 to 15% of the population, but they were a third of the total troops in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, exploited in war and then left to deal with, you know, unchecked racism upon returning back to the United States.
In one of the flashback sequences, there's a broadcast from a woman called Hanoi Hannah, who's basically like Tokyo Rose. And it's this whole sort of propaganda thing where she's trying to dissuade black soldiers from fighting for this country that has represented them disproportionately in their army, that is not giving them opportunities back home. And it's like, you know, nothing you're saying is not true.
Exactly. It's also, by the way, extremely violent.
Oh,
Just so you know, going in.
It's been a while since I've seen a movie where when people get hit by bullets, and they get hit by bullets a lot.
Yeah.
Like, they do not soft pedal what that looks like.
Yeah. People get shot, they get blown up. It's a lot of stuff happening. It's chaotic, you know, and I think that's a compliment. When I'm talking about a Spike Lee movie, he never gives you too much linear at any given point. Like, he jumps around. He packs idea after idea into his movies. Sometimes these ideas even contradict each other. He shifts his tone. He shifts his aspect ratio. He shifts plots. You know, characters that you think are one thing are going to become somebody else by the end of the film.
And I will say this, if this sounds like, if it makes you think of Spike Lee movies that you don't like, I will say that he can do all of these things and have it not quite come off as well.
Right.
Like Chirac, I think,
is
a movie that is like chock full of really interesting ideas and cool avenues to explore. But by the end of it, it's just sort of exhausting. And it's so all over the place that he doesn't guide you through all of his ideas in a as linear enough fashion. Whereas I think this movie does get you from point A to point B through like all the crazy side paths that he wants to take you on, but he does get you there.
Right.
And by the end of it, I felt like this is a cohesive film, even as it is all these other things thrown together. And even as it veers off in other directions, it always kind of comes back to what it is.
Watching this, one thing I realized about myself is that I've been watching his movies now for going on 35 years.
Yeah.
You know, and he's been making films for nearly 40 years. The first one I saw was She's Gotta Have It, you know, at the Inwood Theater in Dallas, Texas. You know, I was in college.
Yeah.
And I've realized something, that as much as I love that dense, you know, barrage of information and ideas and imagery, what I really respond to the most with him is when he allows his characters to feel things very deeply. And that's absolutely what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There is this wonderful moment where they're learning that someone wants that, that they aren't all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, Lemmy's guy, blanking on his name. What was his name? I'm sorry.
Norm Lewis.
Norm Lewis says, I'm sick and tired of trying to get y'all to love one another. Because he believes in the team.
Mm-hmm.
And the team that has been, you know, friends for decades. And they're sort of descending into, you know, bickering and competing agendas.
Yeah.
So... there are also these moments of physical tenderness between these guys,
mm-hmm.
hugging, hands, close-ups of hands touching other hands.
He'll cut it in a way to where you'll get them a moment of a hug or the moment of a fist bump, like from a couple of different angles, just so you really feel it more.
No, I mean like hands resting on other hands.
Mm.
That happens at least once or twice, and when it happened, I thought he's close up on this. And the feeling of pain that pervades this film and the feeling of loss that pervades this film, you know, these guys cry with each other. And I don't see that enough in movies about men with men. You know, there's, we've been in, you know, for all the talk in the Fast and Furious movies, and I love the Fast and Furious movies, but for all the talk about family and bonds and stuff
mm-hmm.
in those films, there's a distinctive air, and there has always been,
of gay panic,
of no homo.
Yeah.
That has always been the rock in my shoe,
as it were,
with those films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise I love them, but Spike Lee is never afraid to let his characters care for each other.
No, that's...
even if in some of the earlier films they're actually literally being homophobic.
Yes.
Which is something that, you know, fortunately, around the time of Get on the Bus, that
I was gonna
he
say,
started to, like, pivot away from that.
Oh, I remember seeing Get on the Bus with you, and there were people in the audience that were not comfortable with that.
Yeah, I know. And I was like, oh, wow. We got a hostile row in this multiplex right now. But anyway. Well,
you know, to your point, you know, I have all the greatest respect for, you know, Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing, but I will always say that my favorite Spike Lee movie is Crooklyn. Because that movie is so much about family love and maternal love and sibling love and fathers and, you know, all that. Like, that is that movie, I feel like, cuts to an emotional core that he so rarely goes that far into, but he does it so beautifully there. But you're right. That is a thing where I think men in the era where homosexuality is a known quantity in society have had to sort of relearn the idea of being affectionate with each other without second guessing it, you know, which again, I think Judd Apatow of all people has actually been somebody who really has pushed that a lot.
Pretty good about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the guy who kind of made the bromance a thing.
Right. Right. The war sequences
mm-hmm.
sort of evoke actual fear for me. And I feel like that there are things that people say in the movie about feeling like they are surrounded in their own neighborhoods at home, surrounded by the invading force of the police.
Right.
So there's this balance, you know, there's this sort of like narrative balance between the idea of being surrounded by a hostile war enemy and a balance of, and of being at home and being surrounded by a hostile domestic enemy.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. Like, this lingering pain sort of keeps going through the film. Anyway, I just think this is one of the best things he's done in the past 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And he's made so many great movies that I love. But this is definitely in that column of
top tier.
Go here first. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really great.
So Defy Bloods is streaming on Netflix. Artemis Fowl is streaming on Disney Plus. King of Staten Island is available for rent in all the places that rent movies. And our streaming pick this week.
We are aligned.
Yes.
Actually, we are of one mind.
A couple things. First of all, if you missed my TCM stuff where I screened George Cukor's Our Betters, the 1961 Victim, and the 1977 documentary Word Is Out.
Passion! That's what these dances lack today. Passion!
Passion! all three of those films are screening on...
That just hurt my throat.
are screening on the Watch TCM app, if you have that. And yep. All of my and Dave Karger's intros and outros are there as well.
Yep.
Today is Pride in Los Angeles, and also streaming right now is a package of films from Kino Lorber called Pioneers of Queer Cinema. Mm. These are early,
super early
queer films. A silent film from 1924 from Carl Theodor Dreyer called Michael, which admittedly I have not seen.
I haven't seen that one yet.
The German classic Mädchen in Uniform, which has been remade numerous times, mm-hmm. About relationships at an all-girls school. And the 1933 comedy Victor and Victoria.
Victor und Victoria.
Victor und Victoria. The German... early talkie comedy that was famously remade as Victor Victoria in 1982, but was also remade by the Brits,
a few
remade
other by the times, Germans, yeah.
Shot in French simultaneously with a different cast. Like this is it's gotten around this plot, but basically it is the premise that you know. It's about starving theater folks and who hit upon the idea of having a woman pretend to be a female impersonator, and she becomes the toast of Europe.
Right, but when she's off stage. She has to wear, like, a suit and a tuxedo and, you know, all the society ladies.
Swoon.
Give her those eyes.
He's such a pretty boy.
Such a pretty boy.
Mr. Victoria. It's fun. We talked about it on KCRW. What's interesting about it that I am not used to, and there might be a term for this and I just don't know it, but... it is a musical, not only in the sense that there are scenes where Victoria performs in front of an audience, but also there will be dialogue scenes where people will speak in rhyming couplets and they'll sort of sing to a bit of music that is playing behind them. It's not a song per se, but they're singing anyway. And it's...
Operetta.
Is it... I looked up operetta. It didn't quite fit. Operetta.
It's in the ballpark.
It's in the ballpark. Yeah. Operetta is really mainly known as a precursor to what we now think of as the musical comedy, the stage musical.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a neat little snapshot of the. You know, moment in Berlin between the wars when there was...
Well, the last moment in Berlin.
Yes, but where there was actually some growing sophistication about sex and gender and whatnot,
right.
Which sadly came crashing to a halt once the Nazis came in. It's a lot of fun. So we'll put a link in the show notes. There are various theaters and, you know, other film sites that you can rent this from, but it's from Kino. It's the three films collectively are known as Pioneers of Queer Cinema. Do we have room for letters?
Yeah, but I do want to say one more thing. Uh-huh. Just this past week, speaking of... people's ideas about gender. Mm. The Trump administration finalized a new policy of literal discrimination against queer people, specifically trans people.
Yes,
in the Affordable Care Act. And so, whatever you can do to fight back against this, even if it's just like giving money to the Okra Project,
mm-hmm.
OKRA. Which helps trans people.
Calling your senators.
Calling your senators, calling your representatives to tell them that you do not like this.
Yes.
These garbage pigs in the White House. I can't wait for them to go. That's all. Oh, did you get this far and think that we were going to be apolitical?
Ha ha!
Also,
not true.
Stop tweeting J.K. Rowling. You're not helping anyone.
Oh my God! I can't even talk about her right now. What a mess. Do we have time for what? What are you talking about? I got all riled up.
I sent you letters.
Did you indeed?
I did.
I'm going to find them.
Why not? I'll tell you what. Read
Hang on. No, I got it. It's okay. Just wait.
If you want, read the first letter and read the 5-star review, and we'll save the other one.
Matthew, this is a letter from May.
Yes, apologies.
Where are we now? We're like, June. Oh, this is, we're in June. It's June.
Thank you, Prince. It's June.
I found the show a little over a year ago when Alonzo left What the Flick.
Well, What the Flick left me, but whatever.
What the Flick left all the people on What the Flick. And they didn't let him use the name to keep going, by the way. Just FYI. Mm-hmm. Once I found Linoleum Knife, I proceeded to go through all of your previous episodes. Wow,
whoa,
that's a lot of them.
Nearly a decade now.
Your input and discussions have always been a source of comfort for me. Within the past month, my younger sister has passed away. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry to hear about this. And it's been difficult for me to watch movies while I've been grieving. I've asked friends for their comfort movies, which led me to watch both the Paddington movies. They were
perfect choice.
A delight. But even with some of those in mind, I have difficulties. I wanted to ask both of you, do you have any comfort movies? What movies do you like to watch in times like this? Mm. Possibly ones that you find cathartic or made you feel more at ease about losing a loved one. I'm aware this is a difficult topic to touch upon, but I would love to hear from my favorite gay uncles during this time. Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Well, yeah, again, sorry for your loss. This is absolutely a time when movies can provide comfort and distraction. It depends. I definitely, yes, the question, do I have comfort movies? Absolutely. I mean, you know, we talk about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes a lot. What's Up, Doc is certainly one for me.
Yeah.
Singing in the Rain always. Yeah. But, you know, I have found in my own life at times when I have dealt with loss, sometimes I want a movie that will maybe make me cry just because I'm holding it back for whatever reason. And I just need to open the floodgate. So I'll pop in like Babette's Feast. That's a guarantee.
Babette's Feast will make you cry.
The Color Purple always gets me.
The Color Purple makes you cry.
When my father passed, I remember watching Ken Loach's Land and Freedom with Dave.
Yep.
He was not on that side politically, but he was, you know, around for the Spanish Civil War. And so there was a lot about that movie that made me think about him. So sometimes it's almost like there have been moments where I kind of felt like rather than pivot away from it, I went right into it, you know, and just the good cry that I had at the end of that movie felt cathartic and felt like a purge for me.
Right. You know? It's two camps. You're right. Like, one of them is, what will distract me from everything
remotely realistic?
Like, this part of my brain that's focusing on grief. Mm-hmm. How can I close the door for just a couple hours and give that time to take a nap for a bit?
Yeah, while I tickle the other good
while I go into this other, you know, part of my brain. So, like, a comedy that I know I love and makes me laugh all the time. Like you said, What's Up, Doc? Young Frankenstein. Mm.
Ball of Fire.
You also said Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which might be my ultimate comfort movie.
I think so.
Because it's super funny. The musical numbers are fantastic. Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell are amazing together. And it's also gorgeous looking.
Yeah.
Like all the time. And I can watch it anytime, anywhere, over and over. Nigella Lawson talked about it once. She was like, I want to sit down with a giant bowl of spaghetti and watch Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And I thought, yes! So a film like that, which completely takes me away, is like that. Horror movies, weirdly enough, even though people are getting slaughtered left and right, horror movies are that way for me as well. They're this fun, like spooky, like carnival ride that I go on for 90 minutes and it takes me out. Also then, on the other side, are the cathartic films. They might not even be about grief. Or they might be a film that isn't about that isn't meant to be cathartic at all and just hits me.
Sure.
I always go back. I always go back to this, but it happened in 2012 when my mother died. About a month after she died, I had to review the movie Guilt Trip.
Mm.
Seth Rogen and Barbara Streisand, a road picture comedy. And at the end of the movie, Barbara Streisand says to Seth Rogen, "If I could choose a son, it would be you." I might start crying now, but I lost it in the theater. And when I wrote my review, I just said at the beginning of the review, I have no idea if this movie's good.
No, exactly.
I don't know if this movie is good because it crumpled me into a little ball. And so a Spike Lee movie that came out right after my mom died, Red Hook Summer, that nobody saw.
I didn't care for it.
It was the first film I reviewed after my mom died. Mm-hmm. And it's such a melancholy film about loss and about people's lives falling through the cracks and about a young kid who is trying to find his way. And it is such a low key and like I said, very sort of melancholy film that it moved me immensely. Movies where people, and I said this not very long ago, movies where people are being very kind and good to each other,
yeah,
when they're helping each other and loving each other, those kinds of movies make me cry. And so those are the cathartic end of this. So there's comfort by being taken away from the situation that you find yourself in. And then there's, you know, catharsis. And it doesn't even have to be a movie about the thing that is happening to you.
Right.
And
there's a school of thought that, like, horror movies serve the purpose of when there are larger forces in your life that you can't control,
yep,
that a horror movie is this enclosed space,
yep,
where, like, you encounter the thing and then you overcome the thing.
Yep.
And that in itself, it, you know, provides a catharsis.
Yeah. So, I don't know that I gave you good, like, a list of movies to grieve to, but like The Wizard of Oz really does that for me. Like The Wizard of Oz is comforting and moving, and always has been, even though, since I was a child. It's just, I mean, you'll know it when you find it.
I was going to say, you'll figure this out. Yeah.
Anyway, I hope that helped. I don't know if it did.
I'll tell you, a movie, when you talk about people being kind to each other,
yeah,
that works for me, that I just found is streaming for free on Tubi.
What?
Did you ever see Antonia's Line?
Maybe. It came out forever ago in the early 90s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I might need to revisit that one, but that's another one that I remember just making me sob.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's do the 5-star review, and then we'll
There's a quick up. Little 5-star review from...
Please leave us one on Apple Podcasts.
Wait a second. Who sent this? Dugan. I'm glad that I discovered this podcast. I absolutely adore Dave and Alonzo. Their opinions I hold in great esteem. And so should you.
Well, thank you, Dugan. That was very sweet. Reminder to everybody, we have a Patreon page.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. As low as $1 a month, you get extra content from us. And then the higher you go, the more you get. We have shows where we focus on one movie and talk about it for about half an hour. We have LKTV, a podcast of the television. Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yep.
Linoleum Nights. We have
Which is about whatever we want it to be about,
basically.
Yeah.
We have hangout opportunities. We have t-shirts and
I just remembered we have to pick a movie for the LK club meeting.
Yes, I know. We keep
it's
putting that off.
It's the 14th and we haven't picked a movie yet.
I know. Well,
why are we so late?
Well, because we're revamping the hangout and I'm trying to make it work. I have to learn a new thing, but I will learn it and then it'll be great and you'll see. And anyway. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check it out. Please visit our friends on the internet. We have lots of folks who do stuff like this, and we hope you'll enjoy all of that. First of all, check out my other shows, Breakfast All Day.
There are about 9 of them.
Who Shot Ya? Yeah. And my new podcast, A Film and a Movie, which dropped this week. Dan from Deck the Hallmark and I, every week we'll talk about a classic film and a more recent hit that that classic inspired. We just dropped our first episode, which is Matt Zoller-Seitz joins us to talk about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and La La Land. And coming up on Wednesday of this week, you can hear our new episode. Amy Nicholson is talking with us about Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage and Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. So beyond those shows,
I'm going to be a guest pretty soon.
You are. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
Check out what
we're going to talk about, a classic French film. Not the one I thought I would be asked to do, but you know, it's fine.
It'll be fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, the Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, Deck the Hallmark, All Things Cozy, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can, again, subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts, which is where you can also leave us that 5-star review. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, The Lounge, CastBox, Podbean, pretty much all the podcatchers. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Follow him at Blutopia on Twitter, Blutopia, or at Blutopia.com. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Have a good week, everybody. It's still crazy out there, so please wear a mask and wash your hands and protect yourself and take care of other people. And until next time,
goodbye.